Thank you, brethren. Please be seated. We have the opportunity to have a split sermon format today. So for the first split, a local elder, Mr. Scott Delamater.
Let's go over to 2 Timothy chapter 2. 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 3. Paul is writing to Timothy and he's giving him an encouragement here. Among other things, he tells him here in verse 3, he says, "There, you therefore must endure hardship as a good soldier of Jesus Christ." He says there's something you've got to endure. And there's this endurance aspect that we know from this and from other scriptures is a part of what we are called to be and what we're called to do. We're told that through many trials we'll enter the kingdom of God, and that we have to persevere. There are many scriptures about perseverance, about being able to see it through to the long haul. And he says here, you have to endure. You must endure hardship. And so we sometimes read these verses and we think, wow, this whole thing is just a big fight. This will wear us down after a while. And we read the verse and think, oh, well, I've got to endure. I need to endure. I'm going to endure. But notice something about how he says we're supposed to endure. He doesn't just say, you know, we're just hunker down and hang in there. And you get through this life and one day you get to die. That's not what he's telling him. He says, you must therefore endure hardship. And he gives us a little bit of a clue here about how to endure hardship. He says, as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. We don't endure hardship by hunkering down, by withdrawing, by turning inward, by retreating. Those aren't the ways that he tells us here that we endure hardship. Those are easy reactions, and I know sometimes those are the reactions that I tend towards, and that we can all tend towards when we're faced with hardship, is to sort of turn in, close up, you know, get your defenses on. But he says we're to endure hardship as a good soldier, which is a very different thing than one who will just sort of retreat and turn in. A good soldier is somebody who's waging war. If you're a soldier and you're in active service, you're waging war, whatever your part in that is. But you're out waging war. And here he compares us to soldiers. Do you have an attack plan? That's my big question for you today. Do you have an attack plan? Are you waging war? Or are you hunkered down, enduring, till that day that you get to die? Let's go to 1 Timothy 6, because he gives him similar encouragement here. 1 Timothy 6 and verse 12. Again, Paul writing to Timothy. It's interesting. It's a similar idea. 1 Timothy 6 and verse 12, he says, "Fight the good fight of faith. Lay hold on eternal life, to which you were also called and have confessed the good confession in the presence of many witnesses." We're fighters. We're not hunkerers, if that's a word. We're not those who withdraw, who retreat, who just sort of shell up. We're not hermits. It's easy to think of, well, we're in this world, we're not of this world, so we're just going to sort of pull back and kind of put our cloaks on and put our defenses up and endure. Elsewhere, Paul writes about the shield of faith in Ephesians 6. He says, above all, he says, take the shield of faith. But the shield of faith is not something that we just hide behind, right? It's easy to think of a shield and, oh, okay, well, I got my shield up. And he says, above all, take that thing. Okay, so I've got this shield of faith, and I'm just going to kind of hang out here and dodge these arrows and hide behind it. But a shield isn't something that you just hide behind until the arrows stop flying and until everything is done around you. A shield is something that absorbs blows as you're moving forward. In the NIV, it renders that scripture that talks about quenching all the fiery darts. It says it extinguishes the flaming arrows. So it's actually something that's doing something. It's an active implement. It's not just a shield that we sit and hide behind and kind of wait until the battle's over. Again, a shield is something you use as you're pushing forward in a battle, as you're fighting. We're fighters. And our fight is one of faith. It's a fight of faith. It's a war that we fight because we believe something. If we really believe that God has a purpose for us, that God has called us to something, then that drives us. That impels us to fight. To fight for that. Because whether we want to fight or not, we know that our adversary is fighting against us. He's fighting against that purpose. There's a purpose that God has called us to understand, to know, to be engaged in. And we have faith in that purpose. We have faith in that calling for us. We've been talking in the youth instruction lessons about God's purpose for man. There's a purpose that He has for us. And if we really believe that, that's going to fuel us forward. That's going to drive us forward. And Satan's going to fight against that purpose. He doesn't want you and I to be a part of that family. He doesn't want us to achieve that goal. He's jealous of that. He wanted that. And he knows that we have the opportunity to get it. And so despite God, he's going to try and stop all of us from getting there. So we, whether we want to or not, we're engaged in a war. We're fighting against that. But here's where I want you to put aside your sort of images of warriors and battlers and fighters. Because what we are and what we do and how we battle looks a lot different than your typical warrior, than the big armored strongman that you might imagine. That's not the kind of fighters that we are. Though we are fighters and though we are warriors. We have plenty of examples, but I want to look at one today. If you go over to Genesis chapter 37. Genesis chapter 37. We're going to read about Joseph today. Because Joseph is a very incredible example of faith. When you talk about fighting a war of faith, Joseph is somebody who demonstrates this time and time again. And when you look at who he is and what he's doing in the circumstances that he's in, it's really amazing to see that there's this person who has this full confidence in God and a full confidence in God's purpose for him, and a full trust that in spite of whatever the circumstances were, he could move forward, that God had a plan for him. And so he fought, and he fought well. Genesis chapter 37 and verse 2. This is the history of Jacob, Joseph. Well, this is the history of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brothers. So Joseph here we've identified as being 17. He's a young man. We have some 17-year-olds here in the audience, I believe. He's there getting his start, but he's really kind of at the beginning of life, the beginning of adulthood. And if we read through here, chapter in verse 5, Joseph had a dream, and he told it to his brothers, and they hated him even more. And he said to them, please hear this dream which I have dreamed. And he explains to them his dream. And then comes back and explains to them a second time that he had this other dream. And these were dreams that were from God. He knew that they were important. He knew that these weren't just the dreams that we all have. These were significant dreams. And he sensed that. And so he maybe a little unwisely shared them. But he must have sensed that there was some importance there, that God had something planned for him, that God had something in mind for him. And so he you can tell he must have really internalized this because it carries him through. And you see that his understanding that God's purpose is what carried him through so many events. Things start getting bad for Joseph pretty early on in the story. Let's go to verse 23. Here Jacob has sent Joseph out to find his brothers because they were tending the sheep, but they were actually quite a ways off, many, many miles off. And Jacob sends Joseph out to go find them and to make sure that they're okay. So in verse 23, it came to pass when Joseph had come to his brothers that they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the tunic of many colors that was on him, and they took him and cast him into a pit. And the pit was empty. There was no water in it. They sat down to eat a meal. Then they lifted their eyes and looked, and there was a company of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels, bearing spices, balm, and myrrh, on their way to carry them down to Egypt. So here's Joseph, and before he even gets to his brothers, they see him afar off, and they think, we're going to kill this guy. We're done with him. This is our opportunity. They throw him into a pit. His brothers convince the bulk of the brothers, maybe not to kill him, but here, let's sell him. We're going to sell him into slavery. We know this story. And so for us, it's kind of a matter of, yeah, here's the next thing that happened. But if you put yourself in Joseph's shoes and you think, what could possibly be going on here? He was the favorite of his father. He knew that there was something important planned for him. He sensed that in the dreams that he was given. And here, it looks like everything's unraveling. Everything that he thought and understood or believed, it probably didn't make a lot of sense to him. In that moment, he probably wasn't sitting there thinking, ah, yes, I'm being sold into slavery because God has this purpose in mind for me and I see where this is going. He didn't see, I'm sure, didn't see where things were going. Because later we get the sense that he learned in hindsight that God had planned all this. He came to that position and understood it. But there in that moment, this must have been very challenging for him. So he was sold. He was sold into slavery. And we find if we go to chapter 39, in verse 1, Genesis chapter 39 and verse 1, Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. So he was bought as a slave. So here he's sold as a slave to work for some Egyptian. Completely cut off from his family, has no idea if he's ever going to see them again, has no connection to them. He's now very far away, and this has got to be very confusing to him. But if we read through Genesis chapter 39, we see that through all of this, Joseph had and maintained a relationship with God. He had full faith in God and in God's purpose and in God's commandments. We know the story, and so sometimes it's easy to overlook. Let's go down to verse 7. So Joseph has been put in charge of Potiphar's house, and God has made him very successful. Again, Joseph probably sees that and understands that that's from God. Because we see here in some of his comments that he has this relationship and understanding of God's involvement in his life. Verse 7 of chapter 39. It came to pass after these things that his master's wife cast longing eyes on Joseph, and she said, "Lie with me." But he refused and said to his master's wife, "Look, my master does not know what is with me in the house, and he has committed all that he has to my hand. There is no one greater in this house than I, nor has he kept back anything from me. But you, because you are his wife, how then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" He understood what sin was. He understood God's commandments. And he understood here that this was violating God's commandments. He understood that God had brought him to this place and had full faith in what God was doing. He had confidence in what God was doing. It's interesting that this is really the first time that we hear directly from Joseph in the narrative here since he's been sold into slavery. Everything's been about him. And then the first time we hear him speak, he's here basically standing up for God's commandments as the thing that's right and the thing that's good. Notice verse 10. So it was, as she spoke to Joseph day by day, that he did not heed her to lie with her or to be with her. This wasn't a one-time event. We think of the one-time event sometimes where that we read about, if we continue with the story, where she got him in this bad situation and she lied about him and she got him in trouble. That's the one-time event. But leading up to that, it says day by day, she was there enticing him. He was there having to deal with this situation day by day for we don't know how long. It doesn't tell us. It could have been years. But he's there dealing with this situation until she finally traps him. Verse 20, then Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison, a place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in the prison. But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners who were in the prison. Whatever they did there, it was his doing. The keeper of the prison did not look into anything that was under Joseph's authority because the Lord was with him, and whatever he did, the Lord made it prosper. And again, it seems that Joseph probably recognized this. He probably recognized that it was God's involvement because, as we see later in the story, he relies on God. He trusts God. He doesn't even question, I wonder if God was here. He makes statements to Pharaoh that says, I can't tell you the dream, but God will. And he comes back to his brothers and says, God planned this. God organized all of this so that it would happen, so that there would be peace, so that we would be provided for. And he has a confidence in God, probably from witnessing these things in his life. Now, you can look at it from the other side, though, and see that here Joseph has been sold as a slave, and then as a slave is wrongly accused and thrown into prison. And so it would be easy from our human perspective, in a similar situation, to recognize all of the injustice that was done to us and to say, this is wrong. How could God allow this to me? And to fight for our own rights and our own will and our own purpose. But that's not the kind of person that we see Joseph to be. If you'll notice, in Genesis 40 and verse 2, we get another little glimpse into Joseph and the kind of person that he was and the faith that he has. Verse 2, Pharaoh was angry. This is chapter 40 in verse 2. Pharaoh was angry with his two officers, the chief butler and the chief baker. So he put them in custody in the house of the captain of the guard in the prison, the place where Joseph was confined. And the captain of the guard charged Joseph with them, and he served them. So they were in custody for a while. Here's Joseph serving these people, taking care of these people, looking after these people. How do we know this? Verse 5, then the butler and the baker of the king of Egypt who were confined in the prison had a dream, both of them, each man's dream in one night, and each man's dream with its own interpretation. And Joseph came into them in the morning and looked at them and saw that they were sad. This is an interesting statement for two people who are in a prison, that Joseph would walk into the prison and say, oh, they look sad. And he calls them out. So he asked Pharaoh's officers who were with him in the custody of his Lord's house, saying, why do you look so sad today? They had been there for a while. Joseph was serving them. He had a relationship with these people, it seems, because he walks in and he recognizes immediately after they've had these troubling dreams that they looked sad. And he sits down to talk with them about it. Why do you look so sad? This isn't the kind of person who is just hunkering down and enduring. When we think about enduring as good soldiers, as fighting a good fight of faith, we can look to examples like this. This doesn't seem to be somebody who is suffering here and enduring and just hanging in there, right? But he's actually convicted of God's involvement in his life. He's serving other people in prison. He's interested in them. He's concerned about them. He sits down to talk with them here. Why do you look so sad today? And then they tell him his dreams. And he interprets the dreams. Let's skip down to 14. Verse 14. So he tells the butler his dream, the interpretation of the dream, that the butler would be restored to his previous position. And in verse 14, he says, "Remember me when it was well with you, and please show kindness to me. Make mention of me to Pharaoh and get me out of this house. For indeed, I was stolen away from the land of the Hebrews, and also I have done nothing here that they should put me into the dungeon." It's very interesting here that he still recognizes that there is great injustice done against him. He says, I've done nothing that I should be here. But the really interesting statement to me is where he says, I was stolen away from the land of the Hebrews. I suspect that by this point, because this at this point he's probably 10 years or so into Egypt that he's been there. At this point, he's probably already forgiven his brothers. Because if you look at that statement, he doesn't say, I was sold into the land of Egypt. He doesn't say anything about his brothers. He doesn't say, my brothers, my rotten scoundrel brothers, were going to kill me and then sold me into the land of Egypt. He doesn't bring any sort of accusation against them. That's not what he says. He says, I was stolen away. I was taken out of. He recognizes that he was taken out of the land of Egypt, and probably understood at this point even that God had a purpose for him, that God had a plan for him. And he seems to have a lot of confidence in that. He might have already understood what he later tells his brothers. If you look in chapter 50, in verse 20, I can just read it to you. He says, "You meant evil against me," speaking to his brothers, "but God meant it for good." He might have already understood that and already come to accept that, because he had faith in God's purpose for him. He understood and believed wholeheartedly that what God had called him to was going to happen. And so he was acting on it, and he was living on it, and he was moving forward in spite of everything that happens. So we know the story here that he tells these men their dreams, and then they go on and they eventually tell Pharaoh. But notice in chapter 41, of Genesis 41, in verse 1, "Then it came to pass, at the end of 2 full years, that Pharaoh had a dream." It was 2 more years that Joseph spent in prison. 2 years. Sometimes we think, oh, he told this story and they went on, and eventually Pharaoh has this dream and Joseph's out of prison. This is great. But it was 2 years. We don't know how long he had been in prison before that. But we know he spent at least another 2 in prison after that. And we find out that when he gets out, he's 30 years old. So we can calculate that Joseph spends 13 years either in slavery or in prison before he ever appears before Pharaoh. 13 years. Let's look at verse 15. Genesis 41 and verse 15. "And Pharaoh said to Joseph, I've had a dream, and there's no one who can interpret it. But I've heard it said of you that you can understand a dream to interpret it. So Joseph answered Pharaoh," and again, we get a glimpse of Joseph's faith here, "saying, it is not in me. God will give Pharaoh an answer of peace." He doesn't say, I will have to go ask God about it and see if he's going to interpret this. He just answers him. He answers him flat out and says, it's not me, but God will give you the answer. As though he understood God had a purpose here and this was probably part of it. And now God is going to work this out. So God's going to answer it. He doesn't take the credit, but he also has full faith in God that God will deliver for him. In verse 17, "Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, behold, in my dream I stood on the bank of the river." And he goes on to tell him his dream. And we know that Joseph then gives the interpretation. Let's look at verse 38. "And Pharaoh said to Joseph, inasmuch as God has shown you all this, there was no one as discerning and as wise as you. You shall rule over my house, and all my people shall be ruled according to your word. Only in regard to the throne will I be greater than you. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, see, I have set you over all the land of Egypt." It's interesting that here in this passage he identifies Joseph. If you look in verse 38, Pharaoh said to his servants, "Can we find such a one as this, a man in whom is the Spirit of God?" Now, we wouldn't necessarily expect Pharaoh to have a real deep understanding of the Spirit of God, but it does seem to indicate here that Joseph was a converted individual who understood God's plan and God's purpose and had the same level of conviction that you and I can and that you and I are working toward. Let's go over to chapter 45. We'll skip to the end of the story. Chapter 45, verse 7. So Joseph finally reveals himself to his brothers who have returned. And again, this was much later. Joseph was probably about 39. Because we know he was 30 when he started ruling Egypt. There were 7 years of plenty, and it tells us that it was 2 years into the famine that his brothers came first to see him. So he was 39, 40-ish when he finally revealed himself to his brothers. 22, 23 years after they had sold him. And here he finally has this chance to reveal himself. And in verse 7, he says, "God sent me before you to preserve a posterity for you in the earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So now it was not you who sent me here." Again, he had already forgiven him and already recognized that was something that God had arranged. "But God, and he has made me a father to Pharaoh and lord of all his house and a ruler throughout all the land." He saw God's purpose. Again, Joseph was a man of faith in the sense that he believed it. It wasn't just something that he thought, yeah, this is kind of the right way. And I like these things that God teaches, and these are good things. This seems like a good God. He had internalized it to the point that he could act on it and move forward continually in spite of prison, of injustice, of threats of murder, of betrayal by his own family. He had full faith in God's purpose, and that's what enabled him to endure. To endure hardship as a good soldier. He fought, and he fought well. We don't have all the details of how Joseph specifically developed and maintained this kind of faith. We don't get all the glimpses into that. But we get principles. We get principles elsewhere in the Bible, and we can infer some things, and we can fill in some gaps of the things that we know to be true. Let's go over to Ephesians 6, verse 12, because I want to talk here at the end of this about waging war, about how we wage war. Let's go over to Ephesians 6. Because again, we're fighting a war of faith. There are a lot of different wars that you can fight. We're fighting a war of faith, the same as Joseph, the same as so many others in the Bible that we can read about, that we can learn from. We're fighting a battle of faith. Ephesians 6 and verse 12 tells us this: "We do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. Therefore, take up the whole armor of God." And he talks about the armor, and he talks about fighting, and he talks about spiritual warfare. But again, don't jump to the imagery of physical warfare, because that's not the kind of war that we're fighting. We're fighting a war like Joseph fought, where the things that come at us are things like injustices, are things like satanic attacks, attacks against his character, attacks by his own family, betrayal, hurt, pain. We fight against those kinds of things. We don't fight against people. That's what Paul is telling us specifically here. We don't fight against people. We have to identify the spiritual battle. That's really the first step in waging war, if you will, is identifying the spiritual battle. We have to see what it is that we're struggling against that has spiritual implications, because we struggle against things that don't always have spiritual implications. Sometimes we're battling and challenged by something that's good for us. If you've ever taken a really difficult class in school, if you've ever had to train for some new thing, learn some new skill, right, those things are challenging and difficult, right? And they challenge us. But those don't necessarily pose spiritual trials. Sometimes we have physical situations that are outside of our power, right? In the same way that Joseph was held captive. He was a slave. He couldn't do anything about that, right? He couldn't get out of that situation. Potiphar's wife was coming at him continually. He couldn't say, I'm going to quit this job. Right? He was there. He just had to be there, and he had to figure out how to deal with it. So he was in a situation where he was constrained, but he had to learn how to deal with it. Physical conditions like that are not our enemy, but they can have spiritual implications. Some of you are battling some pretty serious health challenges. Health challenges in and of themselves are not spiritual problems, but they can cause spiritual problems, right? They can challenge us. They can cause us to have fear. They can cause us to have doubt. They can, those get to the spiritual issues, right? The physical issues are just physical issues. We have to be able to identify the spiritual issues that are facing us, the spiritual components of whatever challenges are facing us. We have to be able to target those and identify those. A spiritual challenge is one that will lead you into sin. That's a spiritual challenge. Some of you have suffered physical challenges that didn't pose a lot of spiritual challenge to you, because maybe you've handled even bigger physical challenges in the past, and you understand, Satan's coming at me with this one. That's not going to get to me. We can have challenges that come at us that have seemingly little physical implications, but great spiritual challenge. And those can come at us hard. But we have to be able to identify what the spiritual component of our challenge is. If we're going to wage war against something, we have to know what it is we're fighting. And so we have to be able to identify that spiritual component. Secondly, we need to be able to plan for attack. We need to have some sort of attack plan. I can't imagine that Joseph, being challenged day by day by Potiphar's wife, didn't have a way that he was going to deal with it, didn't anticipate it. If he hadn't anticipated it and known how he was going to deal with it, he probably would have caved in at some point. But he knew this was coming at him, and he probably knew it was going to come at him day after day after day after day. And he probably had some way that he knew that he was going to combat it, that he was going to respond to it. He had to be ready for it. We have to anticipate, what are the situations, what are the problems that are going to come up that are going to cause me this particular spiritual challenge? And we can practice our response. We can anticipate what that challenge is going to be, and we can practice our response, whatever that response might be. We can sort of visualize it in our mind. It can be part of your morning routine. You might study, you might pray, you might meditate and think about the things that might come at you in a day and say, I know these particular things are challenges. Here's how I'm going to respond. You might even prepare a prayer, prepare a scripture, have it there in your head, have it ready to go, and be able to say, here's what I need to do. Here's my rationale for why I don't want to do this, or how I need to handle this. And to be able to practice seeing yourself in that situation and saying, here's how I'm going to approach it. I'm going to be able to stop. I'm going to be able to reset a little bit. Think about my purpose here, God's purpose for me. Think about my plan. Think about these scriptures. Have a prayer that I know that I can say, right? Have some idea of the words that I'm going to be able to say to God to help me in that moment. and to be able to attack in that way. Proverbs 20 and verse 18, I'll just read it to you. It says, plans are established by counsel. By wise counsel, wage war. As you're planning your attack, don't plan alone. Talk to people. Other people have dealt with the same kinds of problems you have, that I have. We can encourage each other. We can help each other. Other people have probably overcome the same challenges that you have and can be a lift and can be a boost to you. As you start to plan for attack, include others. Seek counsel. Third point here, learn from the losses. Learn from your losses. Philippians 3 and verse 13. Philippians 3 and verse 13 says, brethren, I do not count myself to have apprehended, but one thing I do, forgetting those things which are behind and reaching forward to those which are ahead, I press toward the goal for the prize of the upward call of God in Christ Jesus. It's easy, I think, especially as we come up to Passover and especially as we really dig in and do this self-examination. It can be easy as you're going through your day-to-day to get into these battles and these challenges and see these losses. See times that you fell short. See times that you had some problem. Be able to reflect on something and go, wow, I really blew that. It's easy to look back sometimes and then let those losses just drag you down. It's important to learn from the losses. It's important to be able to say, I recognize that I fell into that problem because this condition, this situation, I was really stressed out that day. Maybe I shouldn't have let myself be around this person or whatever it might be. Right? There are situations that we can assess and say, why did I fail? Why did I fail here? Maybe record. Here are the things that I want to improve. Here are the situations I want to avoid. Learn from the losses, but then, like Paul says here, move forward, move on. We have to be able to forgive ourselves in that sense. Right? It's very easy sometimes for us to forgive others and very difficult for us to forgive ourselves. We have to be able to do that. To be able to really move on in this battle, we have to be able to, after we've repented, if we've truly repented of something, and God's forgiven us, then again, we must forgive ourselves and we must be able to move on. Or else we're not going to be able to fight effectively. We can't war against something when we're just rehashing a past mistake. Right? A past loss is a past loss. We repent of it. We move forward, as Paul's saying here. In the similar vein, if you succeed, record that somehow. This is one that I have recently been relearning, is that when something goes well, when I do something correctly, when God intervenes on something, record it. I was talking to one of you recently. You were telling me that you have a notebook that contains all of the, every time God intervenes and performs a healing or blesses you somehow. This lady I was talking to, she writes it down, and she has a notebook filled with the things that God has done in her life, with the times that God has intervened. We can record those times because our successes come when God intervenes, when God helps us, when we're able to tap into His Spirit and to use that to help us through a situation. God helps us in those times. It's important for us to be able to look back and not just see the losses, not just see the shortcomings, because those are easy to see. Those are the things that we tend to hang on to. But to be able to also look back and say, I see a history of success here. I see a trend. I see improvement. Record your successes. And then move forward. Renew your faith. Remember, this is a battle of faith. If we get bogged down, if we let things cause us to doubt, cause us to fear, cause us to wonder whether God's actually working with us at all, right? We're going to start losing our battle, because that's really at the core of this. This is a battle of faith. We believe in God's purpose for us, and we want to keep moving that forward. Do things to renew your faith. And this is the constant daily stuff. This is the prayer. This is the study, the meditation, the fasting. Maybe fasting is not a daily activity. But It's that kind of thing that we need to continue to do. Because that's the stuff that renews our faith, that keeps us going in this battle. And again, we can have the tools, the things that we do, recording God's involvement in your life, writing it down. Those kinds of things help us to refresh and to renew that faith. Memorize some of your favorite scriptures, the really encouraging ones. There's really a lot that can be said about memorization, about being able to have recall in a moment when you really need that encouragement. This is a good fight of faith. It's a fight that we get to fight. If we believe that God's called us, that He has a plan for us, that He's sustained us, then this is our fight. This is the fight that we get to go fight. This is the fight that we're going to go fight this week. So I encourage you to wage war. Let's go wage war. Let's not hide from it. Let's go fight. What are you going to do about it this week? Are you going to identify an issue, or are you going to go attack that thing? What am I going to do about it this week? We have the best tools available to help us wage our war. Most of war is not the battles themselves. It's the maneuvering and the planning. If you look at any war, and if you've studied any war historically, you know that the battles are just a small fraction of the amount of time that happens. There's so much that goes into planning and maneuvering. What are you going to do? How are you going to plan? How are you going to maneuver? So that when that thing comes at you, when you find yourself engaged in battle, that you can stand. Let's finish up in Genesis 41. Genesis 41 and verse 39. Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Inasmuch as God has shown you all this, there is no one as discerning and as wise as you. You shall be ruler over my house, and all my people shall be ruled according to your word. Only in regard to the throne will I be greater than you." And Pharaoh said to Joseph, "See, I have set you over all the land of Egypt." Joseph fought a good fight of faith. And here at the end, he stands before the king and he's given a kingdom. Let's do the same.